This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. There's nothing in Lou Lipsett's childhood that suggests he would grow up to be a poet. He was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. Both his parents worked in the garment business. His grandparents lived with his family in their solidly Jewish neighborhood. Well, maybe there was one thing that could lead someone to becoming a poet. Because Lou's parents worked, they left him in the care of his grandparents. In fact, Lou thought they were actually his mother and father. When his sister was born, Lou's mother stayed home and assumed the role of mom, and his grandparents receded into the background. It was pretty confusing for a five-year-old, but as he grew up, the experience made him deeply aware of the way we relate to each other and how we communicate the way we feel. Lou Lipsitz is the author of four books of poetry. His most recent collection is called If This World Falls Apart, and it won the prestigious Blue Lynx Prize for Poetry. Lou's also been a newspaper reporter, political science professor, father, grandfather, therapist. There's more, but maybe I should just introduce him, and we'll talk about it. Lou Lipsitz, welcome back to the State of Things.
Actually, well, thank you. Before. Thank you. Very lovely to be here.
When did you actually start to write poetry?
I started to write in college, and I began writing fiction. In fact, I wrote a novel in college, which I found the other day, typed out, single-spaced on some very old yellow paper. And so I didn't know whether I was going to write fiction or poetry. And my turn to poetry, I always liked poetry, but my turn decisively in that direction came when I worked on this newspaper in Ohio after college. And it was so the work was so hard, so many hours. It was sort of a 70, 80-hour week that there wasn't any time to write fiction. And so I just turned to poetry then. But I'd been reading poetry all along. The stimulus, I guess, in a way, was a girlfriend I had in high school who had the, let's say, arrogance or self-confidence to call herself a poet. It turned out later on in the 60s, she won the prize and became a Yale Younger Poet, and her book was published. So she was quite right. Mm-hmm. She was quite right. And that was part of the stimulus, too, that she was a poet.
You started to write, though, and you were interested in fiction. I'm interested to know about this novel that you found. Had you not seen it for a long time? How long had it been since you'd seen it?
I didn't even know I had it any longer. I remembered the drift of the novel, the plot, you might say, which was about my father disappearing and no one knowing where he went, in Brooklyn somewhere, and then how that was he's discovered. But I didn't actually know I had it any longer. I discovered it going through boxes of, you know, stuff.
You were actually more or less raised by your grandparents for the first 5 years, right?
I was almost entirely raised by my grandparents. And another source of my poetry, I would say, is my grandfather, who was a storyteller and a singer. Not a singer in any sort of serious way, but he sang me to sleep and sang a variety of German and Irish songs. He was a Jewish alcoholic. Now, it's a very rare bird at that time.
I was going to say, is that different than a Gentile
yes,
alcoholic?
Yes, it is. And I'll explain, because if you're a Jewish alcoholic, who do you drink with? There just aren't Jewish bars. I don't think they – I mean, maybe there are, but I never knew of any. So he had a lot of Irish friends.
And he knew all these songs.
And he knew a lot of Irish songs. And I've had a lifelong interest in Celtic music as a result.
And your grandfather. Would you read a poem for us?
Yes. Yes. This poem takes some liberties with the truth. But
well, welcome to the State of Things.
It steers toward maybe some deeper truths. This is called After My Grandfather's Second Stroke. 3 week coma, then he woke one day, unable to speak or move his left arm, but came back, piece by amazing piece. PT, exercise, and after time, it was him again, and we figured the binges would start up. But instead, he stayed in his room all evening, radio on, and let his beard grow out white. Instead of not coming home for a week or coming home cursing five nights in a row, he was silent. After a few hours, he'd emerge for a snack, bread, jam, and tea before bed. We snuck in one day when he was taking a stroll and found the poems. One about the fear of death he experienced before the coma. One about what an insect feels. One about walking alone. One about a woman he could not speak of. One about the ocean and how it might feel to be a blind man stepping out into it, not knowing the size of the waves. One about how he'd seen his mother's breasts when she was drunk and wild and he wanted to run into the street. He dug a secret tunnel under our house leading beyond the lake into the forgotten valley where they spoke a language of clay and remembrance. No one mentioned the poems, but something changed. My anger began to dissolve. And when we assembled at the table for dinner, I noticed how my grandmother, who had not slept in the same bed with him for 30 years, would sometimes, while serving the food, reach over to touch his hand.
Lou Lipsitz reading a poem, After My Grandfather's Second Stroke, from his forthcoming new collection, If This World Falls Apart. So I guess, in a way, poetry is in your blood, in your genes, huh?
It'd be nice to think that.
Did you know about these poems? When did you know about them, and did they in any way influence you or start you to think that you might become a poet?
The first poem I read, I have to say, just I say this for the sake of many people who probably have an image of a writer as someone who knew he was going to be a writer and was writing short stories and poetry from childhood on, and that is not me. I had no interest in literature, despite my mother's best efforts, or maybe because of them. And I read comics. I liked Batman and Captain Marvel particularly. Mm-hmm. And never read anything serious until in junior high school, I encountered Robert Frost's famous poem, The Road Not Taken. And when I read that poem, something happened inside me. I think I became aware of an emotion that I had never felt. I was not aware of feeling that I didn't know I had that emotion. That was a great discovery, and it then led me on into this world, the world of literature and fiction as well as poetry. And I think the emotion I felt with that Road Not Taken poem, we all have roads not taken, but in my case, it called me back to the world of my grandmother and grandfather. That was the road I was once on, and then my parents came along, and I took a different road.
Well, to get a sense of where that road might lead, I wonder if I can get you to read another poem. This one is, in fact, the last book in your collection, After My Grandfather's Second Stroke, the one you read, was, in fact, first. So these are bookends, in a way, in the book. This poem called Psychotherapist at the Landfill, if you'd read the first part of that.
Yes, and this is based on something that really happened, too, a story that another therapist told me. Bob Phillips. On an early morning in my 71st year, it is a mixed thing to come to the county landfill and in the piercing yellow light inter these scribbled notes of bewilderment, attentiveness, and odd, interminable hope. To bury them among garbage heaps and old appliances, 122 boxes of records, manila folders filled with my writing, 40 years of dreams taken down, 40 years of dilemmas, visitations from the archetypal powers, 40 years of human beings talking out loud to themselves and to me, pages, an unbelievable accumulation now, evidence of how we humans struggle and ruminate, trying against so much training, so much fear, to dig through the long, heavy dark and raise the dead, accomplish the slow, uncertain resurrection of becoming ourselves. Because I could not bear to have them shredded, I now carry the boxes out amid the debris and dust of the landfill and lay them here, thinking somehow they will be left alone to decay and vanish in their own time, decompose under the stars. Only I'm wrong. The bulldozer appears so quickly, snorting and shoving things aside, burying the pile in efficient sweeps of its yellow plow. Then they're gone, pushed under. The fine attunements, the record of all I was able to make sense from, gone into the garbage. 40 years' worth in 40 seconds. Instant burial.
Lou Lipsitz reading his poem, Psychotherapist at the Landfill, my guest today on The State of Things. A lot in common, those two professions, poetry and psychotherapy, in some ways, would you say?
Yes, I would. In fact, I take note of the poetry of my clients, the sometimes the explicit poetry of my clients. People say things that are so striking and beautiful and have a metaphoric power. Sometimes it's the process that seems poetic, something about the way the therapy develops, the blossoming kind of that occurs. Or Freud had this metaphor of archaeology digging down other layers because he loved, you know, old objects. There are a lot of metaphors. Mountain climbing is another one.
Going up, going down, one way or another, we're going to figure out who we are. On The State of Things today, talking with Lou Lipsitz, therapist and poet. His new book is called If This World Falls Apart. When we return after a short break, we'll find out what Lou learned from being a newspaper reporter and much, much more on The State of Things. From North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, talking with Lou Lipsitz, professor of political science at UNC Chapel Hill for years, now a therapist. He's also the author of four collections of poetry, the newest called If This World Falls Apart. Lou, you graduated from college at 18, meaning you went there early. What happened here? How'd you?
Believe me, I've never recovered. There was a program at the time sponsored by the Ford Foundation. The idea was to pull kids out of high school who were intellectually capable and send them off to college. Columbia did it, I think Wisconsin, Carnegie Tech, Chicago. My family, there was terrible worry about how we're going to send them to college and, you know, where's the money going to come from. So I took an exam and got interviewed because I knew this Chicago fellow scholarship might be available. And unfortunately, I would say for me in some ways, I got it and went off to Chicago at just before I was 16.
Wow.
I'd never been away from home. At the time, I mean, I went out on the train overnight. Chicago was a faraway place.
Mm-hmm.
And my contacts with home were very limited, very, very limited. So it was actually very tough. I was homesick a lot of the time. But I got through it and got this degree at 18. And then what do you do? It was a poli-sci degree because I had a very influential mentor, and I would call him, or somebody I really loved and took as a model for myself in high school, Mr. Max Blatt. And I was going to become my version of Max Blatt. That was and that's in fact what I did when I became a poli-sci professor. I followed that course. But graduating at 18 and then thinking you're maybe ready to make large choices like career and marriage, it's very confusing. I was not at all ready to make those choices.
What'd you do right out of school then?
I went to work on a newspaper. I decided no more school. I don't want to go to grad school. And so I worked on this small newspaper in a little town in Ohio, and I loved it. Rural Western Ohio, a daily paper. The thing that was great about it was the publisher was a liberal iconoclast in a very conservative area and hired people from outside the area to come in and shake things up. That was his deliberate intention. Wow. And he was pretty successful at it.
Well, we could use more of that, Lou. Let me say that as a footnote to all of this. We could use more of that in America today. But anyway, so.
Okay.
that's a cool idea. You were there.
It was an experience in a world I'd never been in. Here I am from Brooklyn, Jewish neighborhood in Brooklyn, and I'm in a little part Catholic, part Protestant, farming area in Ohio. I love the people. I had a great time there.
What was your staff like? How diverse was the staff?
There was a Native American who had a degree in economics who was the editor. There was a Yale law dropout who was the sports editor.
Where they all end up.
There was me. there was me, you know, this precocious Chicago grad writing about culture and politics, which, of course, I had to learn how to do. They taught me to write, actually, on the paper, how to do real solid daily expository writing. And it was hard work.
But you wanted more time for, you thought, your fiction, so this newspaper work wasn't going to do that. Is that when you decided that you decided to profess? It would give you more time?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a kind of a decision made in ignorance in a way where I thought, well, a professor gets the summer off. I mean, it's simple thoughts. I can write during the summer. I'll make a living as a teacher. I like that idea. And I'll write during the summer. And it was just that simple. And I was lonely out there, too, and I had a girlfriend back east, you know, in the Northeast.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so I applied to grad school and got turned down everywhere except at Yale, where they were desperate at the time for students.
To fill the spots of all those dropouts who went on to write sports, no doubt.
Maybe so.
You're there, so you're at Yale and teaching political science.
I was studying, yeah.
Studying.
I was a grad student, yeah.
You finished there. When did you decide to? And in fact, you had a job somewhere in this period where you were essentially a camp counselor.
Oh, here is one of these turning points in life. Unrealized turning point, potential turning point, another road not taken. I got a job at a treatment center for disturbed boys. Residential treatment center in New Haven, outside of New Haven. Loved the job, took to it, fished the water, had no training, made no money. No one ever said to me, including me, myself, hey, you didn't like grad school, but you love this. Why don't you reconsider what you're doing and become deal with this sort of thing, mm-hmm. Which is what, of course, in life I've wound up doing. Never entered my mind. And we, as they say, got pregnant. And then I knew I had to finish my dissertation and get a job where I could make a living. Because this other, you know, camp counselor type job, much as I loved it, the salary was terrible.
And you were working with, these were boys who were, the boys?
Boys between the ages of about 6 or 7, some, up till about 17. And they're in two different houses, and I usually work with the younger boys. And they were, you know, a lot of them were acting out kids. There were food fights. They were angry. They'd attack each other. You know, I'd get in the midst of it, as the other counselors would. But there was something.
But you loved it.
Something
you found some aptitude, but obviously you got to get to work. You're about to be a dad.
Yeah, yeah, and exactly. And so, you know, I come back to it 20 years later.
Will you read another poem for us, speaking of fatherhood?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Fishing with my son on Lake Champlain.
Yes, fishing with my son on Lake Champlain. My son and I have done a lot of fishing, not any longer, but when he was younger, we used to. And this was an occasion when we were together at a resort, actually, on Lake Champlain. It's quite beautiful. We did a lot of fishing when he was younger, and right here at University Lake in Chapel Hill and around this area and at the coast. And I'm, as you can see from the poem, I'm not much of a fisherman. Anyway, fishing with my son at Lake Champlain. He's a big guy now, not the boy who sat with me so many hours in the sun-flooded rowboat 30 years ago when, despite my ignorance, I did my best to act like a fisherman and show him how. So much has fallen apart, the tangled gear rusted with neglect, so much unsaid, fought over. Yet we can still do this together, sit near in the way men do, focus on tackle, bait, lures, lake, winds, and of course the elusive fish we mean to tempt from their murky world. I see his boyish joy again, sense the depths that lurk beneath our boat. Lucky, a northern pike strikes our lure. We've never seen one before. John brings him in, and I hold him firmly below the head and work the hook out so we can throw him back. He's long, fierce-looking, and beautiful. Square jaw, small, sharp teeth, faint purple markings on his belly. A visitor from the other world. Will he heal, as in the stories? Or say, get serious, I'm supposed to be eaten. A long filament of days stretches across the water. We flick the rod, and the reel lets out the line, almost invisible, knotted here and there, settling quietly downward. Time's flickering cocoon.
Lou Lipsitz reading his poem Fishing with My Son on Lake Champlain from his forthcoming collection, If This World Falls Apart. It's a lovely poem, and it makes me think about those earliest days when your grandparents were bringing you up. You mistook them for your parents.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of relationship and how we relate to each other and just what it is as we flick that filament of time, which is a long filament of days stretching before us and then disappears.
Yes. You know, there was a long evolution in my relationship with my son and my daughter because the divorce was, I would just say, handled poorly, particularly by me. And there was damage done to the kids because of this. There's a lot of grief, unspoken grief and anger. And at the time, you know, here I am, a therapist, talking about these things, working with other people and myself, for that matter, about these kinds of issues. But at that time, which is 35 years ago I was very ignorant and had no idea about – I should have known, but I just simply didn't. I was not – didn't let myself be aware of how deeply the emotions of attachment would be pulled on and torn, and how much repair that needed to be done. I sort of refer to that in that poem, in the fishing poem, you know, the tangled gear and so on. And that certainly has happened with my children and me, that we've worked pretty hard to repair the damage.
Had you given much thought to that, really conscious thought to the way these relationships work when you reflected on your relationship with your grandparents and then sort of almost startled to learn that these other younger people were actually mom and dad?
No. I think what happened to me was more like a trauma, I would say, at the age I was, which was about 5. I would say it was more like a set of traumatic experiences, losing the people I thought I was attached to and having to attach to other people I barely knew, truly, my mother and father. You would have thought that would make me keenly aware. But no, what happened was I repressed it all. So I just moved on smoothly. Well, it wasn't really smoothly. I had all kinds of disturbing childhood neurotic symptoms. But they passed after a while, and so I was not conscious of these things. And to some degree, I repeated the mistakes made with me, that my parents and grandparents made with me. I repeated those mistakes with my own children.
It's a pretty interesting lesson in the sense that we're not really, or do you think that any of us are really able to extract ourselves from our own future? I mean, how much is our relationship with other people important in reflecting those things to us, even though there are experiences? You say, I should have known, there it was right before me.
Yeah.
Do you need somebody else to say, hey, look at this part of...
You need someone in your family, at the very least. This is what I think is vital. If there's someone in your family, if my mother, for example, or my grandmother, or any of them, had stopped to reflect on what was happening, if we had been a family that talked about our feelings and what was going on, it would have made me aware that people could do that, that you could reflect and could try to sort out your own feelings and what was happening. But we didn't do that. There was a lot of grief and sadness in that family that was never brought to the surface. And awareness and a model of some kind, you know, someone who shows you how it's done.
Do we keep all these things secret because we think we're the only ones doing it? It seems to me that since we're all, in a sense, victims of this grief and these losses, we all suffer them. That's what we have in common. So why are we so secretive about the one thing that we all have in common?
Well, I can say one thing about men in particular, that my experience with men in therapy and in the men's movement is that there's a lot of shame around this. And it's probably true for women in many ways, very much the same, and maybe not quite as bad, that talking about these things brings up a sense of weakness or shame. I have one client who says to me, don't call it weakness. It's okay if you say I'm sad. He says rather militantly to me. So
right.
It opens up the door to, you know, the vulnerability.
How much of that do you think is social? I mean, that's just the role that we've been handed, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you have to live up to that thing.
I think it can be undone. I think it's possible to change that. I wouldn't be doing therapy, really, if I didn't think these kinds of changes were possible. Why bother? It's in the men's movement, for example, I've seen this happen, where guys getting together. One guy, I was just at a men's gathering 2 weekends ago, and one guy stood up at some point and said, toward the end of it, he said, he was new there. It was the first time he'd come. And he said, well, this has been wonderful. I don't think I've ever been with a group of men where we weren't focused on competition, power, or something else. I can't remember what it was. But anyway, it was not about feelings, not about being open about your vulnerabilities. And he was very grateful. Here's a safe place to do this.
Is this kind of change that you say that we're sort of risking and is too difficult for us as men, something that are we going against our nature not to sort of fight competition, to root these things out and to be more open about our feelings? Are we battling our own nature?
Are we battling our own nature? Well, you're talking to a guy who was like Mr. Competitive.
Mm-hmm.
Once upon a time, I was a handball player, and I was just I was ferociously competitive. But I see it very differently now. And I actually think the competition can take a lot of fun out of the joy of, say, something like sports or games or anything. If you're too competitive, even art, you know, the competition of artists, if it's all competition, you lose the pleasure of the activities.
I wonder if we're talking
to
about
me,
this business of risking change, if I can get you to read The Rope for us.
Oh, yeah, The Rope.
Here. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, yes. Let me find it. I have it.
Lou Lipsitz is my guest. His forthcoming book is called If This World Falls Apart. And we're talking today about his many careers. We haven't even talked about political science, but after this, we'll take a break and come back.
Okay.
Read this one.
The Rope. The Rope. And this is a true story. You know, turn into a poem. 25 feet to the ceiling of the gym, junior high school PS-232, and in one corner, 2 ropes, rough, hand-burning, dark yellow ropes, the test of our guts, supposedly. Climb all the way up or you don't graduate. You stay back until you can do it, they said. I wasn't the only one who believed them. No one taught us. Sure, they showed us once. Pull with your arms like this and wrap the rope around your leg. Get a grip between your sneakers. Whenever I could get up the nerve, when no one was looking, I tried to practice, never making it more than 10 feet before my 12-year-old skinny boy arms failed, and I hung there, legs thrashing. But on the appointed day in June, adrenaline pounding, fear doing its powerful work, I heard my name called, and like a hunted animal, I leaped forward, and before I could register what was happening, the boy who inhabited me went up that rope, arms alone pulling him the entire way, which I had thought impossible. And then, that strange moment at the top, looking down 25 feet, elated and dazed, my altered state just beginning to recede, 25 feet to fall or slide or descend in triumph. Such a long way down, and I was even more afraid. All those years in front of me, and me not knowing any better how to return to Earth than I'd known how to ascend. The teacher yelling, "You can't stay up there all day, for Christ's sake." My arms starting to seriously ache, the fear of falling, but also a wish to leap into the air and discover what might happen. It was only life, after all. And I could glimpse, below me, the rushing water, the rocks, and the girl among the burning flowers.
Lou Lipsitz reading his poem, The Rope, from his forthcoming collection, If This World Falls Apart. So sometimes that competitive urge can bring about great change if we're just foolish enough to.
Plain fear.
Good old fear.
In that case. No, I'm competitive urge. Yeah. Yeah. It has its place. But it's. I'm on the other end now. I was a very competitive person once upon a time. Now, for example, in my therapy work, do I feel competitive with other therapists, for example? No. The answer is no. I'm learning to play the harmonica. Am I competitive with other harmonica players? No, I'm not. I just like to be a decent, competent harmonica player. But with my poetry, I am still competitive. And I'm glad I'm on your show.
We'll find out why as our conversation continues with poet and therapist Lou Lipsitz. His new book is called If This World Falls Apart, and our conversation will continue in a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking this hour with poet Lou Lipsitz. His new book is called If This World Falls Apart. At some point, you did decide to teach political science, and you taught down here at the University of North Carolina. This is 1964.
64, yes.
Yeah, pretty heady time down here.
I was excited to be here, thinking at the time, this is a historic moment in the South. I'll be here 4 years, 5 years, you know, see these dramatic changes or whatever happens. I'm going to be close to it. Can't miss this. I also like the people in the political science department who were very charming and social, and I like the atmosphere. So that was my thinking at the time. I'll be here 3 or 4 years or and then go back up in the Northeast where real life occurred, you know.
didn't turn out that way.
No.
Taught for 30 years, right?
Taught for 30 years, from basically till 1995. Wow. I retired in 95. I started out teaching political ideas and wound up in the end teaching political psychology and literature and politics, which were perfect for me to teach. Sure. And the only reason I left teaching, which I always loved, was I wanted to do something more intimate and challenging to me. I think I'd done it, you know, where teaching was concerned. I had done it and didn't really feel the challenge of doing it any longer.
Well, before I let you leave that profession, I want to know why you stayed. You were planning to leave after 4 years. You didn't. What?
Why did
it,
I stay
was
here?
It, was it
in North Carolina?
Yeah, you just forgot to pack, or
I think it was the grits.
That'll do. No, although shrimp and grits were decades off. You wouldn't even know about
those. Somehow I foresaw that. No, it was a combination of things. Yeah. I mean, we had a second child. There were good years, really, in the political science department. Had a lot of close friends. It was very, very warm. And then we had marital problems, and we split. And I had no intention of moving away from where the kids were. That was very compelling. Besides which, by the 70s, the job market had changed drastically, and it became much, much more difficult to just go out and find a job.
And you were an activist professor. You even tried to desegregate a Klan-operated restaurant, didn't you? Tell us about that.
Yes. A group of us went down to Watts Restaurant on the night the Civil Rights Public Accommodations Act was signed, expecting that we'd be welcomed. Mm-hmm. And they would.
Where was this now?
It was south of town. It's on 15501, just opposite where the entrance now is to Southern Village. Mm-hmm. Watts Restaurant and Motel. And when we got there, there was definitely a welcoming committee for us, but not the sort we expected. We'd call the police. We don't know. The police called them, told them we were coming. It was two cars of people, about eight of us. Bunch of guys rushed out of the restaurant. Some of them had like iron pipes. We were assaulted. It was terrifying, actually. You know, you could say it was a courageous thing we did, but we could have waited till the next morning.
Yeah.
The light of day.
I don't think much would have changed the next morning, but go ahead.
Well, you know, the next week, a bunch of clergy, integrated group of clergy, went restaurant to restaurant to restaurant and basically integrated the town. Because Chapel Hill had a lot of segregated restaurants at the time and motels and so on.
Well, you got beaten up in that episode.
I got hit with something in my in my mouth and broke a tooth, yeah.
Did it change your ideas about, I mean, you've been teaching political science as some kind of a theory. Now you lose a couple of teeth, figuratively. Did it change your ideas about the South, about political organizing, about activism, about political theory?
Well, I think it made one thing very clear to me, which was no. The answer to the question is no. But it made very clear to me the wisdom of thinking through what you're doing before you do it and thinking clearly about the consequences and not acting just on the premise that what you're doing is noble or brave. That's not maybe a good, sufficient, motivation. But when the Vietnam War came along, I mean, that was a war that seemed like a mistake to me early on, and I got that from really reading people who knew something about Vietnam and the war with the French, and I just thought it was going to be a disaster, and, well, I was right. And it was worse than I ever expected, and, yeah, so a lot of us, of course, were, I was far from alone, and yeah, those are my activist days.
So you taught political science, you used literature, you talked about political psychology, and eventually left, became a therapist. When did it suddenly strike you that experience you had at camp as a counselor might have been more than just something to do over the summer, could just be a vocation?
Well, it came from my own therapy. I had, here I was, never thinking I would need psychotherapy, and then, well, yes, I did. And this happened after my father died very suddenly. He had a coronary, boom, one day he was just gone. That shook me up and opened up a lot of things in me that had been sort of closed. And I went into therapy, and I was just fascinated by it. So I was just gripped by it, and that grip did not let go. And I went through a period of 4 or 5 years, back and forth. Can I change my career? Is this crazy? Do I really want to do this? Will I be any good at it? How do I go about it? But finally, it wouldn't relent. And so, like in the rope, I took the leap. I took the leap and said I was going to – so I went to social work school.
A lot of metaphors in that rope, like going to the restaurant where you climb the rope and don't know how you're going to get down.
I'll say. I'm just going to stay up there.
There's that too. But you took the leap, and I mean, it's a lot of work to become a therapist. It's not just can I change careers. It's like, I've got to go through this whole education all over again.
That's right.
And hang out a shame.
That's right. And the deepest education you need is a therapist. I mean, you need a credential and you need training, but the deepest education you need is your own therapy. And I had gotten quite a good bit of that and was getting quite a good bit of that. So, but it was a gamble. It absolutely was a gamble. I did not have any way to know for sure I would get clients, I'd be able to make a career. But it's actually turned out to be better than I could have imagined.
Has it changed?
It was a good hunch.
Has that kind of work, I mean, do you notice periods in your writing that when you're thinking about political science, you write a certain way and now you're a therapist? Does it change the way you write?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I write much more psychologically oriented work. And in fact, the next book of poems, if it ever materializes, it's about half written, is all about being a therapist. The HBO series In Treatment?
I'm sure there is one.
Yes, there is one. It's become fairly well known. Okay. It's about the life of a therapist. Yeah. And it's a very admirable series, really. It's very good. And it's as if that guy is writing poems about his work. So anyway, the next book will be a book of therapist poems.
It also seems to me that in the work you do, you come up against every day the way we reveal and the way we conceal and the way words are used to construct identities that are sometimes helpful but often not, and also conceal identities that if they could come to the surface would be so much more helpful.
Yeah.
Which makes me wonder if you don't become suspicious of words and wonder, what am I doing here with these? What's your relationship with words now that you know how they play such an important part in constructing your own identity?
Well, that's a very difficult question, actually. And words are just, you know, poetry is not made up of words. Just to say a sort of odd thing for me. The words, I can't think of a good metaphor at the moment, but, you know, as they say, the map is not the territory. And and the when you're on the ground inside a poem, you might say, there's something more there than the words. There's the undercurrent. There's the sense of the movement of the poem. There's what's not being said as well, which you sometimes don't know, but sometimes you can sort of feel it, and what the words evoke. So I guess I've just become, it's become a more tender thing to me, words, and I'm more, maybe more sensitive about it than I was.
Go ahead.
No, sorry.
I wanted to know about your involvement in the men's movement, which is something that you discovered as part of your new career. Tell us about that.
Oh, the men's movement has meant a great deal to me, and I've been involved probably for 20 years, starting with the early sort of burst of activity, Robert Bly, Michael Mead, other sort of leaders of the group. And I learned so much about myself and my relationships with other guys. The competitive model has sort of went out the window. And this is a different model of guys relating to each other. It's rather joyous and warm and very deeply moving. And it persists that way. It continues that way. It's not always successful. And, you know, we've failed because the men's movement, I mean, how many men have really ever gotten involved in it? Just a small percentage, and most of them are middle-aged, middle-class white men. But we haven't given up, and there's a sort of a secondary men's movement that's developed now called the Mankind Project, and I don't know a lot about it. Mm-hmm. I'm not involved in it, but it seems to be, gaining some momentum.
Is it just something for personal development, men's personal development, or is it something that should, in some ways, if it were successful by your measures, lead to a change in our social order as well?
Yeah, yes. I mean, if you think of it in a more far-reaching terms, yes, it would lead to changes in our social order. But it's hard to imagine that happening. In the 60s, you know, there were a lot of ideas about a different social order, but we don't have that different social order. In fact, we have that same social order, but that is a competitive, right, more money-oriented social order that even more so now.
Yeah, there seems to be an even more fierce devotion to the kind of competition that ruins us so often.
Sometimes I want to write a poem about the beer commercials, the Budweiser commercials. I'm going to do this one day, about the sort of mockery of men and men's stupidity and as if young men don't have any deep feelings. Right. They're just a bunch of jerks. That's just,
well, and your response in the face of it is, look, here's what you are. You know, you're a slacker and a do nothing. So have a beer and just get it over with. Right. I mean, that seems to be the message.
Yeah.
Kind of painful. I wonder if I can get you to read another poem now.
Okay. Sure.
Solomon's Mistake.
I'd love to read this. This is a poem that some poems just gestate over a long period of time, and you don't know why they're doing it. But actually, based on what we've talked about today so far, actually, there's a good explanation for why this poem is the way it is. Okay, so it's called Solomon's Mistake, and it begins with a quote from the Bible, from Kings, which describes the famous story of Solomon and the two mothers. And the quote is, "And the king said, 'Bring me a sword.' So a sword was brought before the king, and the king said, 'Divide the child in two, and give half to the one and half to the other.'" So part one, the story of King Solomon and his brilliant solution to the competing claims of the two mothers is propaganda. Solomon was busy that day with matters of state and a long list of supplicants. Plus, his middle-aged depression had grown more severe. He tried listening to the rival claimants, each tugging on the infant's blanket, their multiple bracelets echoing in the throne room. They sounded like lying harlots to him. Wishing to be through with it, he sent them out to procure lawyers and dig up the proper documents he knew did not exist. It was only outside in the courtyard, as they went on shrieking, that a soldier threatened to solve the problem by cutting the child in half. And then the true mother stopped him, offering to give up her claim, while the other cunningly just waited. And so she, the deceiver, was the one who received the baby that day and raised it as her own. Part 2. Years later, when he was older and considerably more tranquil, Solomon had the habit of strolling out among his people and one day encountered the real mother and asked about the child and the dilemma presented to him years before. And so he heard the story of the angry soldier and the threat, how she had given up the child. And it was then, as she wept, that Solomon realized what he could have done so many years before to reveal the truth. In a flash of despair, he discovered this wisdom, not the effortless solution mythologized by those who prefer the idolatry of kings.
Lou Lipsitz reading his poem Solomon's Mistake from his forthcoming collection, If This World Falls Apart. And so you say this is the rumination of middle-aged anxiety.
Yeah, middle age is, to me, middle age is just incredibly fascinating time. My own middle age was a time of great change in my life, and I see this, you know, over and over again, people confronting deep issues in themselves. And this story, of course, the Solomon story, this is one of the things about middle age is that you feel despair and you realize the things that are gone and the mistakes you've made and those sorts of things. And so here's Solomon, the great, brilliant Solomon. He acquires wisdom, but it's a different kind of wisdom. It's the wisdom of a mistake that he can't change any longer. It's too late. And, you know, the story of the two mothers is actually very personal to me because I had two mothers, and one gave me up to the other. So it all has a very personal, deep resonance for me. That's probably why I wrote the poem.
Lou Lipsitz, great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure.
Lou Lipsitz is a therapist. He's a poet. His latest collection is called If This World Falls Apart. It'll be out in print as soon as the printers get it out, but you're still doing some readings, and we're talking about the book, right?
Yeah, I'm going to give a reading on Thursday in Raleigh in a house, someone's house, and anyone who's interested can write me at loulipsitz@mac.com and get the address, and also a reading at Flyleaf Books on the 14th at 2 o'clock and in Durham at a Health Touch. And that, too, is online on Friday night, the 13th of May. And McIntyre's on the 22nd of May, that Sunday afternoon.
Lou Lipsitz can be reached at loulipsitz.com as well. And this is The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.